At 6:20, this is KERA News. I'm Justin Martin. A Richardson police officer was remembered today by friends, family, and law enforcement from across Texas and beyond. David Sherrard was fatally shot last week while answering a disturbance call at an apartment. Richardson Police Chief Jimmy Spivey talked through tears about the 13-year police veteran and SWAT team leader who loved his wife, family, fellow officers, his job, and God. The chief called Sherrard a true hero.
And he made that sacrifice coming to the aid of people he'd never met, people he didn't know. It was no accident that David Sherrard was number one in that stack that went into that apartment. David knew it was his time to lead. He knew that people depended on him, and he rose to that occasion.
At today's funeral at Watermark Community Church in Dallas, Sherrard's wife, Nicole, spoke of a marriage that at one point nearly ended in divorce, but she says he worked to make their relationship stronger.
We had finally hit the perfect marriage, and we were each other's best friend. Dave set the bar very high as a husband. He was an amazing example of what a husband should be to his wife, and I'm grateful our daughters got to witness just how much he loved me so selflessly.
David Sherrard was the first Richardson police officer killed in the line of duty. He was 37 years old. Fort Worth Mayor Betsy Price is just back from a trip to the nation's capital. She was the only Texan at yesterday's White House ceremony where President Trump unveiled his $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan. Price stopped by KERA studios today.
It's a very robust infrastructure conversation that we really haven't had this kind of focus from the administration since way back when Eisenhower brought on the interstate projects.
Price is comparing Donald Trump to Dwight D. Eisenhower and his infrastructure plan to Ike launching the interstate highway system. It's a bit of a turn for the mayor. She was absent from Trump campaign events in North Texas when he ran for president. Now the commander-in-chief is even calling her his, quote, fantastic friend. KERA's Rick Holter asked whether the feeling is mutual.
There's a lot of hyperbole there, I think.
You can listen to the full conversation tomorrow night at 6:20 during All Things Considered. We all know the feeling of sitting in a meeting that seems to drag on forever. Morton T. Hansen is management professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And today on Think, he talked with host Chris Boyd about how to make meetings more effective.
If you look at a lot of things we do at work, we are almost on autopilot. We do them, and maybe we are doing them okay, and we just keep repeating them. Take meetings. I ask managers running meetings, how many meetings do you run a day? And usually they say at least two. Okay, so that's about 10 a week. That's about 500 a year. That's about 1,500 meetings in 3 years. That's a lot of meetings. And we know that if you run a good meeting, a lot more stuff get done in a good way. And we know a bad meeting, we've all been there. We know how ineffective that is. And we also know what a bad meeting leads to. It leads to a follow-up meeting because you didn't resolve what you were supposed to be resolving in the first meeting. So it's a terrible way to work. Now, how can you improve your meetings? Well, think about, first of all, what is a meeting for? A meeting should be for only one thing, and that is to have a good debate. If what you're doing is status update, just sharing something, you know, put that in an email.
Morton T. Hansen is the author of Great at Work, How Top Performers Do Less, Work Better, and Achieve More. This episode of Think airs tonight at 10, and you can subscribe to the podcast at think.kera.org. On Tuesdays, KERA's One Crisis Away series looks at life on the financial edge. Today, exploring how computer models might help predict which children are more at risk for abuse. The answer is often those living in poverty. That's the argument central to a recent piece for Reason magazine written by Naomi Schaefer Riley. Courtney Collins spoke to her about why the idea of using big data to analyze risk isn't a brand new concept, but how better algorithms are allowing it to be used in brand new ways.
Currently, 3 million kids are investigated for maltreatment every year. 700,000 of those cases are substantiated. What does that say to you about how the child welfare system currently works?
Well, it turns out that about 1 in 3 children under the age of 18 have actually had some contact with the child welfare system, which I think is an overwhelming number. And I think we can safely say that a lot of those cases are obviously, as you said, not substantiated. But it means that a lot of kids are having contact with child welfare when there's absolutely no need for it. And it also suggests to me that I think workers in our child welfare system are being completely overwhelmed. There's basically a fire hose of reports being thrown at them. And the question is, how can we really expect them reasonably to sort through them?
So let's move on to talking a little bit about predictive analytics. Can you kind of explain the basics of what that means?
everybody's familiar with Moneyball and the ability that we now have to create algorithms that essentially use all of the data that we can collect about baseball, or in this case, families, and plug it into these algorithms. And I am not a mathematician, but they will essentially spit out a score for a family. So we are collecting data about families all the time. And obviously, this disturbs the more libertarian-minded among the population, but it is there. I mean, we have data about kids from schools, from welfare systems, from whether they receive various public benefits, from the healthcare system. And what's happened in the last few years, the first step that was required was that these systems in different states had to start talking to each other. You know, suddenly people who were looking at child welfare could actually access data from schools and could actually access data from, you know, medical records or, you know, data from welfare benefits. And what they did was they've essentially taken those data points and tried to, you know, put them all into this system. And the algorithm that they developed tried to look at the likelihood, essentially, that a child would be subject to abuse. And then once a score is spit out, it's not, oh, they scored a 10, let's go remove the child from the home. Rather, it's actually a way of determining for a caseworker how urgent this case is to be looked at.
There are some states that don't have abuse and neglect in the same category, right? So sometimes there are kids with multiple reports of neglect that kind of precipitates a serious abuse case. But if that data is not kind of paired together, those red flags might be missed.
Yeah, this was actually kind of surprising to me. And essentially what you have is a situation where the data is helping people to make this decision, but you have to have the right data, and you have to have a lot of it in order to make these decisions. So as you said, in some places, we're reporting neglect in a different system from abuse. So neglect might include, for instance, that a family has been found to be living without heat or electricity or running water.
Why is there concern this data might at least lead to overreporting in minority communities?
Abuse is much more of a factor when there's economic instability in the home. You know, parents who are fighting about money have less stable relationships, and there are also many more conflicts with children as well. So these are some of the factors that you might find as a result of, you know, lower economic outcomes in minority communities. You might find that it's not just that investigations of abuse are more prevalent, but that abuse itself is more prevalent.
Because poverty correlates with child abuse and neglect, and because minority neighborhoods tend to be more poor, does that kind of create a chicken and egg problem?
It could. The one thing that I will say, and I thought this was one of the most interesting points that was raised by this woman, Emily Putnam Hornstein, she said, if you're really concerned about the problems of racial bias in the child welfare system, the first thing that you have to think about is, what is the alternative to using big data? We're often depending on kind of the gut instincts of child welfare workers who walk into a home. So data actually might not be in some ways the best system. It might not be in some ways the most objective system. But when you compare it with just sending a particular person with their particular biases into a home to look around and see what they think, I think that raises all sorts of problems as well, and problems that might be worse because there's nobody kind of looking at the big picture here.
Naomi Schaefer Riley is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. Her article, "Can Big Data Help Save Abused Kids?" appears in Reason magazine. Cloudy skies in store for us tonight. There's a 40% chance of rain this evening with a low in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, cloudy, 30% chance for showers with a high in the upper 60s. It's 6:30. This is KERA News.